Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Bria Barthel. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with commentary that the New York State Legislature failed to take action on major climate legislation before ending their session. Then we hear about the nurses' union's work to get a contract approved with Albany Medical Center. Later on, the Black Theater Troupe of upstate New York shares information on their upcoming Juneteenth activities and other summer activities. After that, a Reclaiming History segment reviews the 3,000-year history of Egyptian culture. Finally, learn about how and why the nonprofit organization Mission Accomplished introduces young women to entrepreneurial skills. But first, here are the headlines.
Congress has overwhelmingly voted to make Juneteenth a national holiday to celebrate the end of slavery for everyone but prisoners. The Federal Office of Personnel Management confirmed that the Juneteenth holiday will start this year, with many federal employees able to take Friday, June 18th, as a holiday because June 19th falls on a Saturday.
The Spectrum News site State of Politics reports that advocates for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are increasingly concerned that programs and agencies that provide services to the state's most vulnerable populations are facing a workforce crisis. A survey of 100 service providers in New York found a 93% drop in applications to fill positions that provide services and are considered the backbone of the system to care for people with disabilities.
More than 4 million people say they fear being evicted or foreclosed upon in coming months, just as two studies released Wednesday found that the nation's housing availability and affordability crisis is expected to worsen significantly following the pandemic.
The Rensselaer City Council voted in favor of a resolution calling on the state to close the Dunn Construction and Demolition Debris Landfill in the city, the largest in the state. East Greenbush also passed a similar resolution. Neighbors have long complained about the odors, dust, and truck traffic, as well as the negative impact on the nearby school.
Now that lawmakers have gone home for the year, the governor announced that he will open the state capitol starting Friday. Many advocacy groups complained that even as the rest of the state loosened COVID restrictions, they were prevented from directly meeting with lawmakers in the closing weeks of the session.
And our final headline comes to us from Public News Service.
A measure to end college transcript withholding due to outstanding debt didn't pass this session, but its supporters will continue advocating for those affected by the practice. Ripple effects of transcript withholding range from a student's inability to complete their degree, apply for certain jobs, or return to school. Melanie Crivellis with Young Invincibles says it's disproportionately impacting low-income students and students of color. And the issue is cyclical.
They have this outstanding debt and they're not actually able to get those high-paying jobs, pay off that debt because they don't have the credential.
Data from December 2019 to March 2020 show SUNY students from Black or Latinx neighborhoods are 8 to 10 times more likely to be affected by institutional debt collection practice lawsuits. While the bill passed in the state Senate, it failed to move out of the Assembly Committee. Young Invincibles says they will take the issue to the next legislative session and continue research into how this practice impacts New Yorkers. Crivellis notes these debts are not state, federal, or private loans. They're ones specifically owed to the higher education institution. And the Student Borrower Protection Center found that schools receive very little money when they collect on the institutional debts. Ending transcript withholding would put priority on all students being able to obtain a degree.
What it would really do is say that this particular practice of holding students' transcripts hostage runs counter to the purpose of our higher education institutions.
Research by the not-for-profit group Ithaca shows that a college degree has the potential to increase a person's lifetime earnings up to $600,000. In the U.S., California, Washington, and Louisiana are the only states that have passed similar legislation so far. For Public News Service, I'm Michaela Savitt.
And that's it for the headlines. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA LP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA LP 107.3 FM Albany, coming from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
Our mission is to use art, science, and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from sanctuary sustainers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call us at 518-272-2390. Now for our first segment, we'll hear Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Mark Dunley talking with Pete Sikora about how the New York State Legislature went home for the year without passing any of the major climate legislative proposals.
We're joined today by Pete Sikora, who is the Climate and Inequality Campaign Director for the New York Communities for Change. And he recently had an op-ed in the, Focus site. Albany just blew it on climate again. Pete, how did Albany blow it on climate again?
Oh, hey, Mark. By not passing any significant legislation at the scale of the crisis and by not funding the climate solutions and investments in jobs to make a huge difference. And that's what we need right now. So they just whiffed once again.
And there were quite a few climate bills, the CCIA, corporate polluter penalty pay, bills to stop new fossil fuel infrastructure, fossil fuel subsidies, public power. There just seemed to be a host of issues that were put on the table about climate. Why were the legislature so unwilling to take any action?
Yeah, you know, it's not a lack of thoughtful and actionable proposals that's the problem here. The problem is that the enormous special interest money and lobbying behind the scenes and corporate power that restrains action whenever their profits and executive compensation are threatened. So to overcome that requires a movement of activists and a really focused, aggressive campaign. So the article I wrote argues that needs to happen immediately and did not happen this year. And that's part of the reason for Albany's inaction.
Well, it sort of summed up in these two sentences you wrote. The inside game will never work on issues that seriously threaten deep pocket corporate interest. And for major change, you need relentless outside mobilization. And then you cited campaigns such as ban fracking, some of the campaigns to stop particular oil and gas pipelines, even the divest from the New York pension funds. Why were those successful and why didn't we see similar efforts this year?
Those efforts were successful because a group of dedicated activists and organizations mobilized at scale with a large multi-year effort that involved hundreds, if not thousands of people in taking action. And so that's the scale that it takes to get to make major politicians bend to popular demands. And that's why those efforts won. And conversely, why this year's legislative efforts did not win. Legislators whine about being pressed by activists and they complain and the governor doesn't like it either. And unfortunately, too many groups are too deferential to the inside game. They don't want to go out and criticize politicians for failing to act. And instead, they try to preserve their access and ability to lobby them. They don't want to have their meetings cut off. And that is a approach that will doom New York to failing to take major action. You can win little stuff with smart lobbying, incremental changes here and there, little nips and tucks to the system. What you can't win is the scale of change necessary to deal with the magnitude of the problem.
Now, one of the sub-headlines in your article in Focus was fighting big environmental fights often means fighting against corporate environmental groups. You know, how do the, you know, what are corporate environmental groups?
These are groups that cover for the system. In some cases, they're funded by corporations or by wealthy individuals who do not want large-scale change. So they present as environmental organizations, but depending on the issue, they may actually be undermining strong action or outright opposing it. So that happened on fracking, where big, well-funded national organizations actually opposed activists who wanted to ban fracking, which is crazy in retrospect. But at the time, was, you know, a major reason that activists had to overcome. Of course, the main opposition comes from the oil and gas industry, various corporate interests, but it doesn't help when there are so-called environmental groups that are willing to front for those interests.
You know, one factor that especially the media cited was that the state legislature, you know, basically was in a lockdown situation, which made it obviously more difficult for people, you know, doing direct protests, confronting legislators to do that. And it was sort of interesting as politicians demanded that Cuomo open up the state as COVID, you know, vaccinations took off. The one place they never demanded that the governor open up was the state capitol.
It certainly helps to be able to confront legislators in person and get a lobby them, talk to them directly, pressure them, do direct actions, yell at them. All of those things actually make a very big difference in a well-run and focused campaign. So it sure didn't help to have the capitol off limits. However, there were very strong outsider-focused mobilizations and campaigns that did win major change. NYCC, for example, was heavily involved in the push to raise taxes on the rich and also to fund money for excluded workers, undocumented workers, and other workers who were not getting any sort of unemployment help and are truly desperate in the coronavirus crisis. So those campaigns did employ very serious pressure tactics at scale, and won, despite being unable to enter the state capitol.
I guess 2.5 years ago, maybe even 3 years ago at this point, the state passed the CLCPA, sort of a landmark, you know, climate law that was cited as an excuse by some of the legislative leaders. Let's wait for this council to come out with this advisory report as to our next steps. What should, you know, the climate movement in New York State be doing at this point as the clock continues to tick, you know, towards, you know, global warming tipping points?
I think that there needs to be a recognition that being sucked into the governor's micromanaged process to theoretically advise and inform the implementation of the CLCPA is and focusing on that is a huge mistake. Instead, there needs to be a relentless, large outside mobilization to pressure the governor to actually act on climate. Right now, the governor's subgroups are failing to recommend, even just recommend, the pollution cuts and job creation necessary to implement the already kind of two minimal goals of the CLCPA. And the reason that that's happening is that the governor is not feeling the pressure to act on this issue. So people need to get in the streets. They need to get into a serious campaign that puts the outsider pressure on to then implement that law and exceed it, as well as passing the many obvious budget and legislative and regulatory items needed besides the CLCPA.
So one of the issues that certainly New York Community Should Change and others is heavily focused upon is the need to, you know, halt new fossil fuel infrastructure, which has often been translated into fights against particular gas pipelines and also some right. power plants. This is not something that even the progressive Democrats, you know, necessarily been willing to push. In our last minute and 15 seconds, how do you deal with going after the fossil fuel industry?
The Clean Futures Act is prime sponsored and heavily pushed by a progressive Democrat, Zohran Mamdani, in the Assembly and Jabari Brisport in the Senate. And that bill would prevent construction of all large utility scale fossil fuel power plants. That's one good way. And that's an example of a bill that ought to have passed. To take on the fossil fuel industry requires a large mobilization to pressure the governor and secondarily the legislature and individual legislators and legislative leadership to take action at the scale of the crisis. There's no shortcut. It takes people in the streets pressing in significant numbers to become a relentless political force that they can't ignore.
We've been talking to Peace Corps, Climate and Inequality Campaign Director, New York Communities for Change. Pete, if people want to both check NYCC out and also this recent article in Focus, how best can they do that?
They can go to the New York Focus website and read the story. They can call me on my cell, 917-648-7786. They can email me, and they can go to our website, nycommunities.org. My email address is pete.sikora@gmail.com.
Thank you very much, Pete Sikora. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio.
That was Pete Sikora of the New York Communities for Change talking about how the New York State Legislature failed to pass pending climate legislation before ending the session. And there is a link to Pete's article on the description of this story on our website. And you can find that and other stories on climate at mediasanctuary.org/stories.
Next, Willie Terry, Hudson Mohawk Magazine's roaming labor correspondent, provides an on-scene report from a June 15th picket by Albany Medical Center nurses fighting to get a contract with AMC. He talked with Jennifer Bejo, a nurse in AMC's intensive care unit.
Yeah, this is Willie Terry, a Roman labor correspondent for the radio station Hudson Mohawk Magazine. And I'm out here at the EM Urgent Care Center on New Lawton Road, where the nurses, Albany nurses, are holding a protest. And I'm gonna get the information of why they are holding this protest. And I have, as my guest, your name is?
Jennifer Bejo, and I've been with Albany Medical Center for 15 years, working in ICU.
Oh, okay, Jennifer. And Jennifer, y'all are out here today on a humid day. What's going on?
Well, you know, like we have been like negotiating issues that are essential to us, you know, like nurses at Albany Med for over 3 years, and you know, there were no problems or any issues like, you know, coming from the nurses that are left hidden. You know, everything were brought to the surface and let known to management and administrators for so long. You know, people need to understand that we care. We nurses like care a lot about our, you know, like our patients, and we care so much too for our profession, and we have always, you know, like put our patients first. We also like cope with little support to no staffing, like, you know, inside a hospital, and you know, succumb to like, you know, these undesirable working conditions has gone over our working hours, and only to like realize and only to find out that we are, after all this time, you know, we are being taken for granted. We are being taken for granted as professionals and essential workers. You know, like we all want a contract. We all do, regardless.
Yeah, all union members.
We are union members. The union is the nurses. We all wanted a contract, but we refuse to submit to anything that is not guaranteed and fair for all nurses. We will not accept, like, you know, any changes that result in incomparable and unimproved levels of benefits and access to health care. We wanted to, you know, like have a language, you know, set on our contract that truly values, you know, our service in the hospital, like a language that strengthens, you know, our retention in the hospital. And Albany Medical Center administrators, you know, like should be willing to address like all these issues and resolve them, you know, especially on economic discrimination. We all believe equal work for equal pay. And until we achieve that, until the day that we get that contract, we will be left Here, we will constantly be out in the street fighting, negotiating, and we will protest if need be.
Jim, what is the particular protest today at this particular institution, the EM Urgent Care?
Well, you know, like the clinics of Albany Medical Center, there are still, like, you know, essential, like, you know, nurses, essential workers at the front lines, you know, at emergency, like, you know, urgent cares. These are the clinics of Albany Med. And, you know, like, whatever that we benefit on our contract, like, one day would also, like, benefit them. Whatever, you know, like, working conditions, may it good or bad, that affects us nurses at Albany Medical Center Hospital will eventually also, like, affect them. Because we all are nurses. We all take care of our community. We all take care of, like, you know, sick patients.
So you started today, I was looking at the schedule, at 8 o'clock this morning. What are the other two places?
We first started, are you asking about, like, the places that we hit today? Yeah, we started at the South Clinical Campus, like, at around 8 o'clock in the morning. And now, like, you know, an emergency urgent care at Latham, and we're going to move forward at Niskayuna.
Now, what's been the community respond? I hear a lot of horns blowing.
Yeah, and it's very, like, very uplifting. All that, essentially, it's like, you know, what is important, like, you know, on this day is that community needs to know that they need to support their nurses. We need help. We need a contract that we're still, like, fighting for so long. Management at this point are not, like, negotiating, like, fairly. They give us crumbs. They give us, like, bits and pieces of, like, you know, of the package. But then, you know, they neglect to, like, you know, resolve the issues that actually, like, affect the nurses' lives, you know, in all aspects of their lives. And that is, like, you know, not only, like, pay, not only, like, you know, benefits, but, you know, like, healthcare and retention and retirement. So these are the things that we're, like, left fighting for, right? That we are fighting for right now.
I know your struggle been going on for a while. So there have been no movement from management to sell the contract?
Yes, there is, like, you know, a little bit of movement. That's why we keep, like, pushing. We plan for all these, like, you know, activities, like, you know, outside the hospital. So, you know, like this informational picket. So everybody will know, like, you know, what we are encountering, or, like, you know, the issues that we are facing, like, you know, inside the hospital. We keep pushing. We keep moving forward. We keep the momentum, like, you know, up.
Now that the CDC has want to lift the mask mandate, what is the nurse's position on it?
We have not, like, you know, talked about it, but at this point, you know, our focus and our attention is, like, more on making sure that we are protected, the nurses, right, the caregivers are protected, as much as, like, you know, we also maintain the safety of our patients that we care for.
Mm-hmm. Now, have things slowed down at the hospital in reference to the COVID situation?
It slowed down a little bit, but, you know, I mean, like, you know, as long as there's COVID patients, like, coming in and are left, like, in the hospital, it's still, like, you know, quite worrisome, like, you know, because everybody is, like, you know, left unsafe at this point.
Well, I know that the government, you know, the president, they voted on a bill, I think it was called the HERO Act, and cities got a lot of money. I know hospitals got a lot of money. Have they said anything to y'all about that? I mean, the city itself, because they, you know, got to divvy out this money, and I know they give a certain amount to a lot of institutions, and I know the hospital gets some.
You know, like, basically, like, you know, I'm a nurse. Like, I'm not a politician. I'm not into politics. I don't know what's going on with politics, but as long as, like, they guarantee the benefits and, you know, like, the and the nurses and essential workers and the hardworking people are taken care of and are valued for what they do, they can do, like, whatever they want. Like, you know, we're all for it. We support it.
There's a lot of building going on. You know, there's a lot of construction going on around the hospital.
And that's why we keep fighting for, you know, like, at the negotiating table, because they need to, like, you know, essentially, you know, like, basically put their profit, like, you know, to their nurses and, you know, like, exclude, like, you know, some unimportant, like, you know, factors, you know, like building, you know, buildings, and they need to protect, because once you build a building, you're still going to staff that with people. You're going to staff that with workers. Afterwards, what's going to happen? If you don't take care of these people, if you don't take care of nurses, of essential workers, you don't, you know, you neglect to like protect these, you know, like essential workers, they're gonna leave. You're gonna just, you know, it's just like the last straw to like, you know, break the camel's back, and they're gonna be forced to leave.
Albany Med is a hospital not just for people living in Albany, but for people all over the capital region.
Yep.
And what's been the community support in terms of y'all struggle help? They came out?
We understand, you know, like we have always like, you know, the nurses, the profession, our profession has always been voted as like the number one, you know, like profession. Basing on that, I would think like, you know, we believe that, you know, the community support is on us. Mm-hmm. You know, they treated us as heroes when we were there, protecting their family and taking care of their family during the pandemic. There's no doubt in our minds and in our heart that regardless of like what happens, you know, community are still going to be there to support us.
So at this point, where do y'all stand now?
We are going back to on the negotiating table, and we're going to keep on bargaining, and the next bargaining session is going to be on the 22nd of June. We're still going to continue that, waiting for them to like, you know, absolutely like, you know, give us like a fair contract. And, you know, like, it's a matter of time, you know, before we actually, like, you know, we'll be able to, like, get it. But it needs to, like, you know, it needs to be, we need to, like, have the support of, like, every sector, like, you know, in the community. We need, like, you know, every support of all the nurses at Albany Med. We need to stand up together. We need to, like, struggle together. And, you know, we reap the benefits, like, afterwards. And AMC needs to start, like, listening to their nurses. Because, I mean, like, they've been, like, you know, they pretend, you know, they keep this pretense that they're actually, like, hearing us, but they're not listening at all. And until that we get a contract, then that's the time that we're going to believe that, yes, Albany Med is actually, like, listen to us.
Well, what could the average person in the community do to help y'all, aid y'all?
At this point, go after the lawmakers. Go after, like, the officials. Go, you know, go after, like, you know, the local, like, you know, officials. Who may have at one point, like, you know, told us that they're going to support us, but are not doing actually anything. Go after, like, the board members of Albany Medical Center. Go after, like, you know, the businesses that, hey, you know, there is a problem. Because the nurses are outside, like, you know, picketing on the street, there is a problem inside a hospital. So they need to, like, help us out.
Now, how can someone get in touch with the Nurses Association? Do you have a website?
We have also, like, a website. Yep. NYSNA.org, and you can, you know, go through that, and then you see, like, you know, when's our next activity, like, you know, in the near future.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you.
No problem.
Appreciate.
That was our roaming labor correspondent, Willie Terry, talking with Jennifer Bezo, a nurse in Albany Medical Center's intensive care unit, about the nurses' union's work to get a contract. Tune in every week for another Labor Bucket segment by Willie Terry.
For those just tuning in, I'm Bria Barthel.
And I'm Sina Vizilahickey. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or find us on social media at Media Sanctuary. In the headlines, we mentioned that Juneteenth has just become a national holiday. In this segment, Jean-Rami Monet from the Black Theater Troupe of upstate New York talks with HMM's Andrea Cunliffe about some of the troupe's upcoming Juneteenth events in the capital region.
This is Andrea Cunliffe with the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. We're speaking with Jean-Rami Monet, the actor and artistic director and producer of the Black Theater Troupe of upstate New York. It's been a year since we last spoke with you, but I've seen that you've done so much this year. Even with all the COVID problems we've had in theater for the Capital District, well, all across the country, but you've been very busy doing play readings and working on other projects. So let's catch up with what's been happening with you this past year and what you've got planned for this summer.
I'm sitting on my porch, and it's nice outside. I'm talking to you. It's a nice day. I have my script in my hand, getting ready for rehearsal tonight. I told you I'm directing Ant Misbehaving for the Park Playhouse too, right?
Well, you know, I am so blown away by everything that you've done this year, even though there's been this horrendous thing. I mean, I've got stuff here. You've done readings for the Capitol Rep. That wasn't that long ago. You've done all sorts of stuff.
Well, I've done a couple. Just the last couple of months that I perform, and then I directed one. It was a Zoom reading, and I've been working with CapRep for a while now. In good partnership, we collaborated in a lot of stuff. So,
yeah, so I see. I was really impressed, and all you know, you've
Thank
done
you.
All sorts of good things. You've got now, am I right? You've got Camp Logan.
Camp Logan, we did a recording of it. Actually, Camp Logan was our first big production back in 2012 with the Black Theater Troupe. Back then, we were a Soul Rebel performance troupe. And then when I retired from the States in 2018, I decided to go full-time with the Black Theater Troupe. I changed the name to the Black Theater Troupe in 2018. Now, for Juneteenth, collaborating with Capitol Rep Theater, and then we're doing a virtual reading of Camp Logan. It will be recorded and will be aired on June 19th, this coming Saturday. And it's going to be on a lot of different platforms, you know, Amazon. It's going to be on Apple TV and Practice Collaborative. You know, it's going to be aired from the 19th to the 22nd. People can get a lot of information on the Black Theater Troupe page for that, for Camp Logan. It's a very powerful story about Black soldiers that was based in Camp Logan, Texas, during World War I. And those soldiers were there training, getting ready to go to the war, and they were being harassed by local whites. And then there was a riot, and they ended up hanging 20 Black soldiers in Camp Logan, Texas. So the story was written, this is a true story, written by a Black playwright, Celeste Walker, who lives in Texas. And she wrote the play based on that story back in 2017.
Sounds very, very powerful.
Yeah, powerful play, very educational. The thing is, a lot of people are saying, you know, well, slavery was a million years ago. But we need to move on. Look, we cannot move on until you know the story, what happened in the past. And a lot of people don't understand what we're going through right now. You know, it's not something that just started. You know, it's something that started back then. Until you understand the history of it and go back and you'll never understand, you know, in all what's going
Absolutely.
On now. So
you can't go on if you don't know where you're going from.
Exactly. Yes. Thank you
just,
very
you
much.
You just make the same mistakes over and over. Then you've
yes.
got something Saturday barbecue. What is this? It centers around an Irish family, and it's going to be a...
Before I go on barbecue, we actually have something that just came up. We did a Juneteenth event last year, 2020. Yeah, we collaborated with Michael Kennedy, the two theater companies. Well, it's not a collaboration, but Kathy Lena and MLK Saratoga asked the two theater company to work with them on a Juneteenth project. It's a collaboration because we use the same actors. So for the Black Theater Troupe, and then we had this event last year. We broadcasting that event, and it's also, I just posted it on Facebook, also it's going to be on this Saturday, just for one day.
Is it a play?
It was a live performance that was on at Cafe Lena, and it was on YouTube. And it's pieces and about things about social injustices and about Juneteenth, about things that's going on now. We have actors performing live. We're broadcasting that this year also on the 19th at 4:30. So the Black Theater Troupe has two things going on Saturday. Yes. But
because then you've got auditions for barbecue.
And
in
then
the morning,
I have auditions at 10:30 on Saturday, you know, for mm-hmm. barbecue, and that's gonna be our first production of our season. So
wonderful.
And that one's going to be outdoor starting August 20th and for 2 weekends, August 20, 21, 22, and then the following weekend again. That's going to be on Livingston Street. It's the home of Stephen Myers. There's a building. It's like a museum. So it's going to be behind there and at the Stephen Myers residence in the back in the yard, like a little park. It is in Albany and on Livingston Street at the Stephen Myers residence. And all the information will be on our Facebook page, the Black Theater Troupe of Upstate New York. It's going to be performed outside, you know, like a it's a family that's planning a barbecue party for, you know, for their sibling who's coming out of rehab. And then it's funny. It's like a dysfunctional family. And then it's hilarious. It's, you know, it's a fun play to, you know, to do. And then that's going to be our first play of our season. Our season starts August this year through June of 2022 next year.
But in the meantime, my friend, you're doing Ain't Misbehaving?
Oh, yes. The Playhouse Stage production every year they do at Washington Park, the musicals. It's always been a dream of me to be on that stage, but unfortunately I don't sing, so it's only a dream. But they reached out to me and asked me to direct one of their productions. They didn't have one last year because of COVID, and this time they're coming back bigger, and they asked me to direct it in Ain't Misbehaving at the Park Playhouse. We're rehearsing now, and then we open in July 6th on the Playhouse Stage. The play is going to be outdoor at the Park Playhouse.
Have you ever directed a musical?
I've never directed a musical before. That's very exciting. I love the play. It's a great story. It's fun. You know, I actually thought it was going to be a challenge. It is a little bit. But when you're working with talented choreographer and a musical director, you know, it helps a lot because you don't do it alone. Because I normally direct straight plays. But you do have a choreographer and a musical director working with you. It's a great thing. And those people are so talented. We have a very, very talented cast.
The script itself is amazing. It's a Tony and an Emmy winner. And it's all about Fats Waller, the great jazz
singer. All about Fats Waller, yes, yes.
Oh, I mean, some of those songs, you know, they're classic.
I was listening, and I've been listening to Fats Waller every day. I'm in my car. It's Fats Waller I'm listening to.
But there's just something so invigorating, so exciting about the music of that era with someone like Fats Waller. I mean, no matter how gray and grim and horrible life can be, he, you know, is the true spirit lifter. And it's just...
This is what I like about this business, the art and theater. It's a lot of work itself. It's very stressful, but it's good stress. If I'm stressed about something else in life, you know, going on, look, you know, and I say, okay, I need to be involved in the production somewhere, you know, and it makes me feel so much better because it's good stress. So that's what I do. Now I don't even have to look for it because that's what I do every single day. I go to sleep, I dream of it because, you know, I'm at night, I'm thinking, okay, about blocking a show and about, you know, what I'm going to do. So, but it's all good. It's in, you know, I retired from the state after 30 years and I have plenty of time to, you know, to focus on this art that I'm passionate so much about.
And this has been Andrea Cunliffe for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, speaking with Jean-Remy Monet, the actor, artistic director, and producer of the Black Theater Troupe of Upstate New York.
And the Black Theater Troupe of Upstate New York has a virtual performance happening this weekend from June 19th through June 22nd. And you can find information about this event and other works and information about the group on their Facebook page, which is at Black Troupe Upstate.
For a perspective on African history, we'll now hear about how Egyptian culture developed over 3,000 years. The second part of an interview by Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Livonia Mallory with Dr. Solange Ashby of Calling Out to ISIS.
It's great to have you back on the show again, Dr. Ashby. Can you tell us, when did non-Africans start to move into Egypt proper?
It was not until later periods when Egypt started being conquered by outside forces, the Persians, the Assyrians, then the Greeks and the Romans, that we start getting a more diverse population of people moving into this incredibly rich area along the Nile.
one of the things that I realized just trying to understand the timeline, you use terms like the new kingdom. That means nothing to a person who doesn't know the history of Egypt at all. Mm. If there's a new kingdom, does that mean there was an old kingdom? And what timeline are we talking about? And Doc, I really get confused with this AD, BC, and we start counting back. So
yes,
when you say 4,000 BC is long ago, but 2000 BC is closer to our timeline. Am I right?
Yes, ma'am. So really, it is a total a calendar built around the birth of Jesus Christ. So anything that is happening in the before the BC, before Christ period, is necessarily counting down to that theoretical year zero when Jesus was born. And so we're counting down from these really high numbers, thousands of years before Jesus was born. And so I'll just, if I may, really briefly go through the different kingdoms that are part of this really long 3,000 years of Egyptian history. So there's the pre-dynastic period when there are people living in the Nile Valley, but they've not yet come together in a unified state or a powerful kingdom. And that first happens around 3,000 before Christ, so 3,000 BC. And so then we have a couple of short dynasties, so series of families ruling, and the old kingdom then, those people who established their capital at Memphis, which is now sort of buried under modern day Cairo in northern Egypt, and built the Great Pyramids at Giza. That's about 2600 BCE, BC. So we have moved forward now 400 years. And this is an amazing ancient kingdom. They build really great, huge monuments and develop the Egyptian script called Merunetcher, in Greek known as hieroglyphs. But then that kingdom sort of falls apart. And so there's an intermediate period until the Egyptians reunify their country. And then we have what's called the Middle Kingdom. So that's about 2000 BC to about 1850 BC. So about 150 years. And this is considered the classical period of ancient Egypt. So amazing literature is written. We have really powerful kings. I've written articles talking about how some of their queens, I think, are Nubian women who are marrying into the royal family. And then again, the country falls apart. There's no more centralized rule until the new kingdom. And that starts around 1550 BC. Its power base is in the south, much like the Middle Kingdom, and they go ahead and reconquer the whole Nile Valley in Egypt and establish the New Kingdom. And this is the phase of Egyptian history with the pharaohs that most people are likely to know, like Akhenaten and his wife Nefertiti, Akhenaten's ancestors, Thutmose III, who grew Egypt's empire to its greatest extent, his aunt, stepmother, Hatshepsut, the female pharaoh. Tutankhamun is in that New Kingdom period as well. And then Egypt, it sort of falls apart again around 1000 before Christ. And then there is sort of this period of disarray and then foreign invasions into Egypt. And one of those invasions, which Egyptologists like to call foreign, but I tend to see as an indigenous Nile Valley reunification, is when the Kushite kings from further south in Nubia come into Egypt and establish their rule there as Egypt's 25th dynasty. And that's from about 750 before Christ until about 650, so about 100-year period.
And those were known as the Black Pharaohs, correct?
Yes, and we're really trying to push back on that sort of terminology because as so many others with whom I work have said, calling them Black Pharaohs implies that the other pharaohs in Egypt were not Black, and that is not true. If we're saying that Egypt is an African civilization, calling this particular group of pharaohs from the south black and not the other pharaohs implies that they may have been otherwise. And I don't see it that way.
If you're just tuning in, you are listening to another segment of Reclaiming History. I am interviewing Dr. Solange Ashby. She is an Egyptologist and a Nubiologist, and she's written a book called Calling Out to ISIS, The Enduring Nubian Presence at Philae. I want to talk about the Nubians. You are a Nubiologist, and you mentioned the Nubians a lot in your book. What role did the Nubians play in the culture and religious practices of the Egyptians? And how is that related to the temple at Philae?
Mm-hmm. So there's a long and a short answer to that. I'll try to do something in between. But I like to say, and it is true, that the Egyptians and the Nubians arise from one people in this pre-dynastic period. So like 5,000 years before Christ, cattle pastoralists wandering around the Sahara that was a green savanna at that point due to changes in climate. But then when it starts to get dry around 4,000 before Christ, those same people, small population groups, move to the Nile to get refuge and to find water for the cattle that they are herding. And so in the beginning, before there was an Egypt, before there was a Nubia, they were just this population group that was cattle herders in the Green Sahara. And so I like to point that out to start. They essentially start as the same people, but then they develop very differently. And so during the pharaonic period, during this period of kingship in Egypt, I've become very interested in tracking the Nubian presence throughout all of these phases of Egyptian history. So I published an article in 2018 talking about these wives of a Middle Kingdom pharaoh named Mentuhotep II, who seemed to me very clearly to be Nubian women. But Nubians are just showing up everywhere. A 12th dynasty king, so also Middle Kingdom ruler, tells us that his mother came from Ta Seti, which is an Egyptian way of calling Nubia. So there are just Nubians throughout all of Egyptian history. But my book focuses really specifically on the role of Nubian people over essentially a 1,000-year period at this sacred site of Philae, which is a temple complex built on an island in the middle of the Nile. It's such a beautiful setting.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to another segment of Reclaiming History. I have a very special guest on the line.
Dr. Solange Ashby, Egyptologist. She just published her first book,
Calling Out to ISIS, The Enduring Nubian Presence at Philae. It's published by Gorgias Press.
That was the second part of Hudson Mohawk Magazine Livonia Mallory's interview with Dr. Solange Ashby, who is the founding member of the William Leo Hansberry Society, which seeks to create pathways for people of African descent on the continent and in the diaspora to engage in the study of African antiquity. And to hear the first part of this interview and the following interviews, visit our website at mediasanctuary.org/stories.
Returning to current times here in the Capital Region, we now hear about programs offered by the nonprofit organization Mission Accomplished Transition Services to introduce young women to entrepreneurship and related skills. HMM's Dulcinea Diggs talks with Coach Carmen Duncan, the founder of Mission Accomplished.
Hello, this is HMM correspondent Dulcinea Diggs for WOC 105.3 FM, and today I'm speaking with returning guest Coach Carmen. I am here at her event for young teens, Social Entrepreneurship Showcase at the Ground Up Cafe. Please welcome Coach Carmen. How are you doing today?
I am just peachy.
That's just waiting to see it. All right, tell me, what enticed you to open up Mission Accomplished?
When I was in my teenage years to my early 20s, I had people who mentored me, who sponsored me, who coached me, because they truly seen the potential in me that I didn't see in myself at that time. So once I got to a certain point of my life, I made the decision that my life work needed to be investing in people the same way that people invested in me, through mentorship, coaching, and sponsorship. And so mentorship is more informal, coaching is very results oriented, and then sponsorship is about making sure that people have access to the individuals, the financial resources, and other resources that are really going to help them get from where they are today and where they want to be.
Now, honestly, I love that name. How did you come up with such a name?
When I came up with this name for the organization, I felt like I accomplished my mission against all odds. It is to provide industry-specific career education through mentorship, coaching, and sponsorship. And so our focus is really to meet people where they are at and then help them with establishing goals and action steps so that they can get to their desired outcome. And also, because I am a master's level social worker, we take on a trauma-informed approach. So we really do talk with people about any type of traumatic experiences that they may have had that may hold them back from pursuing their wildest dreams. So, we start out with mindset, and then we move into brand development and marketing, and then we move into the behind-the-scenes responsibilities. And then we move into public speaking and celebrating and just moving on to the next phase of your life, particularly your professional life, but you can't focus on just professional.
Definitely.
If you don't have your personal items in order, at some point, it is going to bleed into your professional life.
Amen to that one. Now, why did you choose working with children as opposed to, you said you have a master's in social work, so you can work with why did you choose young teens?
Well, we don't only work with teens. Okay. We work with individuals from the age of 13 to 35. And that age group was specifically selected because those are the individuals that are early in their career, and then to the individuals who are in the middle of their career. And a lot of times, companies do not invest in the growth and development of entry-level to mid-level professionals because they don't necessarily see them as individuals who are bringing income into the organization. They just see them as worker bees. So Mission Accomplished is an organization to connect with the individuals who are in that entry-level space, in that mid-level space, and let them know that they are worth it and that they too make money for companies, whether it be theirs or it be a company that they are working for.
And why is it important that children are aware of entrepreneurship?
It's that self-motivation and self-actualization and knowing that you don't have to depend on a big corporation to help you do what you want to do in life, to help you make a change in the world. You do not have to work for a large corporation. And quite frankly, you can plant a seed that is going to be the next big corporation if that's what you would like it to be. And then just, as a Black woman, it is in being a part of the Black and Brown community, I feel that it is important for us to understand that we can create our own work cultures when we are not accepted in other cultures, or cultures, work cultures that say that they want to accept us. And then we get there and it's like, why do you dress like that? Why do you talk like this? There's just a whole bunch of code switching, and that really contributes to increased mental health diagnoses such as anxiety and depression, personality disorders, what have you, because you have people telling you that you shouldn't be who you are.
Wow. tell me, is this an event you'd like to host annually?
We do host this event annually, so it will be around the same time next year, with the hope of having some more teenagers here as well.
Okay, and how can people become more involved in Mission Accomplished?
You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at MISSACC12. You can certainly make a financial investment in the organization to sustain this growing legacy organization at matransitionservices.org. That's matransitionservices.org. Or you can contact us by phone at 518-207-0209, or by email at inquire@matransitionservices.org. Mission Accomplished Transition Services is where passion meets purpose. So if you are an individual out there between the ages of 13 to 35 who has an interest in fashion, beauty, interior design, construction, or social entrepreneurship, we are the organization for you. And if you are someone who is not in between that age range, but you want to support individuals within that age range, whether it be through volunteering or making a financial investment, Mission Accomplished Transition Services is the perfect organization for you to make that legacy donation.
Well, Coach Carmen, I would just like to thank you so much for this interview, and thank you for inviting me to this space of beautiful young women of color making it in entrepreneurship.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you making the investment of time in us today. You've been with us all day, and I appreciate that.
Of course, this is great. Thank you so much.
All right.
That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Dulcinea Diggs speaking with Coach Carmen Duncan of Mission Accomplished. And for more information, the website is matransitionservices.org.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Bria Barthel, a volunteer co-host. If you'd like to try out radio broadcasting, contact us. We welcome new volunteers.
And I'm the co-host for tonight, Sina Bazilahicki, also your engineer. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community, for the community, and is supported by independent donations. Thank you to all of our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org.
This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, or to suggest topics for our segments, please email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. To get a link to those sessions, contact us. Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org/stories, through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast, and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in. Have a nice Juneteenth holiday.